Welcome to Chaotic Harmony. My name is John.
This is Crystal. We talk about the joys and the challenges of teaching music in the elementary school classroom.
We share struggles, we brainstorm solutions.
And we would love to have you join us.
Live from the wires underneath Omaha, Nebraska. Sorry, I came with a weird one. Because we are between two states, welcome to another episode of Chaotic Harmony, episode 97. Woo! We are getting up there. I'm your host today, Jonathan Seligman. And today I have a special guest. I know I say special each time, but they just keep on getting more specialer. I don't know what to do with all this, but I bring to you the shaker, the brilliance, the ball of fire, Rachel Pack. How are you?
Yay! Thank you! Wow, that was so kind and jubilant. I love it.
Yeah. How's it going? Yeah.
I'm doing so good. Today was my first day back. Technically, we had PD today and then tomorrow and then the kids Wednesday. So I've just been moving and grooving.
So you have not started yet?
Haven't. And this is my first year starting off like as a teacher fully because I came in mid-year last year after practicum. So it's big business.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that part in a bit. But yeah, Rachel, the first time I saw you, met you, was actually the first time I've ever met you. The first time I ever met you. To our listeners, I mentioned back in episode 82 that I went to the inaugural AA/ACPI Music Education Gathering. I like to call it the Meg. It's just like places in there. And I want to say that I mentioned this in the recording, but I was hella nervous going into there for a plethora of reasons. I actually almost turned around and left before I arrived. Yeah. We can get that later.
Yeah, I had no idea. I would never have been able to tell.
Oh, really? Well, that's cool because you were the first face I met. I don't know if you remember that. Yes, you were the first. And so I first met you. You kind of greeted me at the door. And like after me, I met John Lee afterwards. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I just knew it was going to be a great time. So I appreciate this warmth that you constantly exude.
Thanks.
Yeah, of course. Like, well, but then you dropped the ball.
I dropped the ball.
Yeah, you said you guessed what my karaoke song was going to be. That I was going to be singing Whitney Houston. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't, but alas.
Yeah.
What was your first thoughts about me?
I was really off.
Yeah. What was your impression? I'm curious. When you first met
Like my first impression of you?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh, he's like a cool uncle. That's how
Uncle.
Yeah. Okay. That's how I view, because at the time I was still a student.
Yeah.
So you guys all looked like real adults to me. So I was like, oh my gosh, it's like I have all these like cool like aunties and uncles now and like brothers and sisters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, mm-hmm. I appreciate that. But this is not about me. This is about you. So let's start this off. First off, as you mentioned, you are young in the profession, but you are extremely active, like really active, I'd say. Like you present events such as, you know, Massachusetts MEA, also out of state. You have a podcast that has over 50 episodes. And you've only been teaching.
Wow, you did your research.
I'm gonna check in. Yeah, but you've been only teaching for a little under a year.
6 months.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So I guess it's safe to say you're passionate about music education. If you've done all this and then you started to, so what brought you to this road of music education?
To like talking like specifically about what I end up talking about a lot, or just like music.
No,
ed
like
in general?
What brought you? Yeah, to music ed. Like what did you do? Like when you were younger, that you were eventually like, you know, education in the musical realm was something I wanted to pursue. Like what was it?
Oh well, so my first instrument was violin, and it was Suzuki violin because you know that's like Asian baby rite of passage number one.
That or piano.
And so. Yeah, I did violin and I like didn't like it for a long time. But I loved orchestra when I got to middle school and high school because I loved my teachers and also the community aspect of it because I just have always been like very social. And so I loved that I could hang out with my friends and do music. But what really made me want to be a teacher was in high school, my teachers just trusted me a lot. Like they leaned into like me wanting to do leadership positions and stuff like that. But I found that like in orchestra, I loved the leadership aspect of it, but in choir is where I pushed myself like musically. And so then I was like, well, I know I want to do music in some capacity. And throughout when I was younger, I went from like, I want to be on Broadway because I feel like that's also a rite of passage, like thought. And then I was like, maybe I'll do opera. And then I did. Texas is beefed up when it comes to
music
education.
So you grew up in Texas.
Sorry?
You grew up in Texas.
Yes, I grew up in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
I grew up in Northwest Houston to be exact. But they have like really, really strong music education programs there because they're it's very interesting, the whole like dynamics between TMEA and NAFME, because that's like they kind of don't always get along.
Yeah, so I heard there's a split or something, or like they something.
Yeah, we seceded.
Like, really fascinating.
Well, not actually. Essentially, TMEA really likes to do their own thing, and they really are very separate from NAFME than what NAFME like usually likes to do in like conferences. That's why you don't see as many like Texas people at like, I don't know, I guess like involved with NAFME as much. But that's why TMEA is so huge in itself, because they really beefed up their own thing. But my school district was so supportive in the arts like from like a very young age. So we had fifth grade strings, and then the high schoolers could go and volunteer and be TAs. So I was a TA in high school, and I was just hanging out with my orchestra, my middle school orchestra teacher all the time. And I was like, oh yeah, well, yeah, this feels right. And she told me once, she was like, Rachel, I feel like you are gonna be like in a sitcom where like, or your life is like a sitcom where you're like, you wanna go and like be on Broadway, sleep, but then you like find your passion for teaching. And I kind of skipped that whole Broadway part after I did like one summer camp, and then I was like, yeah, I really like music ed. So that's what I immediately went into my major at Berkeley for that.
Okay, gotcha. So Suzuki first, then you said you didn't stick with you. What kept you pushing then? Like, you didn't enjoy Suzuki approach, and like, why did you continue doing that in middle school, or were you just that much in love with music?
It was orchestra. It was being in like a group setting, and having friends.
Getting into orchestra, like, did you not? Was like dropping the string, the violin, not an option?
It didn't seem like an option.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I actually dropped my violin once in seventh grade, and my mom was like, "Well, Rachel, this is your time now. Like, if you want to stop doing orchestra, you want to stop playing violin, here's your opportunity." I was like, "No! I want to keep doing it."
Gotcha.
Push came to shove, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to stick with this.
Okay. So you pursued music. You really enjoyed it, enjoyed the group setting of the communal setting of music. And then from your teachers, they kind of encouraged you to go away from Broadway and more towards teaching. So is that kind of the path?
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole Broadway thing was like a short-lived seventh to like freshman year stint.
gotcha.
And then it dissipated pretty quickly. Okay. So, but I just knew I really liked being involved in music in like some capacity, and I knew I really liked having like a leadership role, and so I got really involved with orchestra. I threw myself into that, and then really pushed myself like choir when it came to like Allstate. That was a huge deal in high school, like TMEA, Allstate choir, camps, the whole loot.
That's cool. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you are currently in Massachusetts, yes?
Okay.
What is your current school like?
My current school?
That you're teaching at, yes.
Oh, I love it. It's seriously like the best first year teaching job I could have ever had. I like tell everyone about all the time, because I feel like I just know how I feel. I don't know. It feels kind of like cheesy, corny, mushy, gushy, but that's also just like who I am as a person, because I feel so lucky that I have such a good first year position, because I've heard a lot of like, for lack of a better term, like horror stories or like just uphill battles like other educators have had to have, especially in their first year. But I feel so super supported by my admin and by the rest of the staff at the school I'm at, because I came in just like middle of the year, end of January, and they all were just like there to help me and welcomed me and were super friendly, and that just meant so much. Like, I get excited to go to school every day, not just because of the kids, but also because like I get to see my friends. And I feel like usually sometimes it's kind of like an either or situation, but I have both, and I feel supported by the district, and I feel like that's not always the case.
That's
so
not it's no, a that's great really culture. Great. Yeah, that's really great. So you're very supported by admin, also fellow staff. Have they had a long legacy of music teachers and you just came in, or like, and you also mentioned that, let's start with that question actually. So, has your school had music for a long time?
Coming from
a California perspective, it's like definitely music is new-ish. So I'm curious.
It's new.
Relatively. We mentioned in this podcast that for before I started teaching, for 35 years down in Chula Vista, there was no arts. So only for the affluent, was it there. So I'm just, I know East Coast is different. So you were entering a school that has had a relatively long lineage of music education.
Yeah, that surprises me about California, because for some reason I assumed that California was like very supportive and like big on the arts, probably because I just assumed it associated with being like having like big cities. And yeah, that, but yeah, that, you know what, that's funny, because I kind of was taken by surprise with the same thing in Massachusetts, but with string specifically. Oh. Because in Massachusetts, string is not always guaranteed, or it's kind of like a rarity to have a strings program, especially like in fifth grade. But I always just assume because it's Massachusetts, and because like there's a lot of like elitism in Massachusetts, and like I think I directly correlate orchestra a lot of the times with like elitism a
Fair.
bit, like to tie it like way back. I was very surprised by that the strings programs in Texas were so much more beefed up than in Massachusetts. But for my school specifically, they've had a music program. And we're lucky that my school for fifth grade, you have the option of band, chorus, or orchestra, which isn't the case at all of the schools in district, but that's the goal, that all of them will have that case, like that option for fifth grade. Specifically my role is general music and chorus. And then we have a band person and an orchestra person come in, and they're traveling in the district to each of the elementary schools.
So you're rooted at one site, and then there's also other music teachers that a music teacher, a second music teacher that comes in, or like, are there a couple that come in?
Nah, it's just me.
Just you. Gotcha. Yeah, I've similarly at my site, it's just me. And it would be lovely if we could have someone come in, you know, amongst the different schools and just teach band or just teach, et cetera. I love concert band, but man, it takes a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you came in mid year last year. How did you get that? How'd you land that situation?
It worked out really perfectly. Mm-hmm. Like I got very, I mean, lucky is the word. So I finished my student teaching at the end of December, and I had heard about like a maturity position in the district. So the district I work in is Framingham, which is a city kind of like 30 minutes out of Boston. And my mentor from Berkeley, he is the fine arts coordinator in the district in Framingham. And he had called me and he was like, hey, instead of a maturity position, I have this new position that opened up and I would love for you to interview. And so I interviewed with the principals and everything, and it just timed out so well. So this person had given a month, the person, whoever I, you know, came in and took their position, they gave a month's notice. And so that was like right on the dot of when I had just finished my student teaching. And so I had a month to like chill out, figure out what I'm doing, and then started right after that and went until the end of the school year.
Huh. Cool. Well,
yeah.
Kudos to you. I'm happy for you. Thanks. I'm glad. I would never have suspected when I first met you that you had yet to have landed a job. Like you were like someone who has a wealth of information, to the point where you've presented a lot, I feel like. And so amongst those, and also the articles that you've written, like I know you've shared quite a bit on just the inequities in music education, something that, there are a couple, aren't there, right? Maybe one or two, right?
Inequities?
Yeah.
Maybe like one and a half.
One and a half. Okay.
Yeah.
First off, can you please state, because for some reason, I feel like educators just still don't to this day understand what an inequity is. Can you please define an inequity so we're on the same wavelength?
Yeah, I would define inequity as like, what's like the most concise way I could put it? That's the thing that's like my Desi goal, making things very concise. Mm-hmm. Inequity. I would say when something is systemically unequal to all students, like heavy emphasis on systemic, because something I like to focus on a lot in the things that I discuss when it comes to inequity and like DEI and all these things is that it's never the people within the system, it's the system in itself, because I truly want to believe that everyone, and this is a hot take, I get flack for this times, but I really do think everyone is inherently good. And I want to believe that it, like, why would anyone try to hurt somebody else? Like, what is the intention of that, especially in our field? But it happens. Yeah. And a part of that is because we are a part of like this bigger system that has a lot of things that are racist, that are all the isms embedded in how we operate. But to go back to the question, I think inequity is things that inherently make things unequal for our students, like specifically in this case for education.
Okay. And would you say it's about being unequal or like not being distributed? Like, I guess you said earlier, it's specifically an unequal distribution.
Yeah, it's the whole thing, like that whole graphic of someone trying to pick an apple from a tree and they give them the box and to create like what is actual equity. So inequity is then like what comes before that is that there's these layers of like things that people are trying to like aspire to, but they can't reach it because they aren't given the same opportunity.
Yeah, I feel like there's a West Coast versus East Coast. Maybe it's not that. I'm just generalizing here. But I feel like the element of what graph do you see? Maybe it's the apple one. Or maybe it's the baseball one. It's like,
yes, I think we talked about that when we were together.
Did we? Okay. Yeah.
It's like, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the structures beneath that affect whether or not everyone is on the same playing field. I like that. Cool. And I feel like you've been focusing a lot on inequity based off of some of the, I'll be honest, I did not sleuth through all of the episodes. I'm sorry. I was tempted. There were some good titles. First off, kudos to you to making good titles. Like,
thanks.
Getting an SEO is like, oh, that's a good one. but like, I feel like you have focused a lot on inequity. First off, why? Why is that a focal point to you?
So, when it comes to talking about inequity specifically on like my podcast in the past, that was a lot because I started it during the peak of all the Asian hate. Yep. So that stemmed from the podcast itself stemmed from I was doing my first project ever for music ed at Berkeley. Okay. And I was in my intro to music ed class with my late great professor and mentor, Jarrett Scheel. And Jarrett was like, everybody's going to make a podcast and you have to interview your favorite teacher who you had growing up. And so I interviewed Mr. Heron, who was my orchestra teacher, who was the one who just like trusted me so much and pushed me to be a leader in orchestra. And then I realized I like talking a lot. And this was also when we went fully remote because I was entering class of 2019 for college. So then the whole brunt, like middle section of my college time was remote, and it was remote or hybrid, especially because there's music ed. So we weren't trying to do anything in person.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. What was that like?
Oh, like being friend.
I mean, I feel like a lot of our listeners are either my age or older, and we have people that are, you know, that have interacted, of course, or are friends with people your age that were students during that time. But how was that like?
It forced me to learn to live by myself really quickly and enjoy it, because I was the type of person where I want to be with my friends all the time. I was going to Target. Hey, who want to go to Target together? I'm going to get coffee. Are y'all around? But it also, I feel like it made me think critically, like really fast, because of also learning to live by myself as like an 18-year-old and navigating all the social issues that were happening at the time too, that were things I cared deeply about. It was really weird because we thought it was all going to last like 2 weeks, just like everybody else. But we were learning everything so on the fly, but also seeing our teachers adapt. So it was nice that I feel like a lot of the professors at Berkeley were giving each other a lot of grace and being very transparent about how they were feeling. Mm-hmm. But it was, oh my gosh, I had to take my licensure test on Zoom and it was horrible. That was probably one of the worst things about it. Yeah. So for Massachusetts, I know for some, like, I feel like the rest of America does the Praxis, right?
We do the TPAs, and ours is a little different as well, but Praxis, okay. I feel like most of America.
Yeah, so I feel like most people end up taking the Praxis, but we do MTEL, so you do 2 MTELs in Massachusetts, communications and literacy tests, and then you do your music MTEL, which boo. I'm music MTEL hater number one. I just retook it. Like,
music MTEL
past
is
summer.
What? For the ignorant like me.
It is, no, not ignorant. You're doing good. You don't need to know about it. It is our licensure test.
Okay, okay.
But it's deeply steeped in white history. It's about European music history. And so some of the questions will be like just about, you know, oh, Bach. It wasn't even Bach. It was someone else where it's like, so and so had an affair with so and so in Music Times.
Probably Lully.
Yeah. Yeah. And, or like, you know, who did the well tempered clavier? Stuff that you wouldn't be teaching in general music class. But so you do both your MTELs. And I did my Massachusetts Communications Literacy one fully remote. So it was really just like, that was a lot of what college was like, was learning how to adapt to make things remote and still like learn. But it was nice because I lived off campus from the start of college because I wasn't able to get Berkeley housing because I'm just the deadline paying for it. And it Berkeley is kind of short on housing in itself. So if you miss a deadline, you got put on a wait list. So then my roommate and I ended up living off campus, which worked out for the better. So I just stayed in Boston the entire time. That I think was probably like the oddest part of it, is it became a ghost town because it's such a college town. You'd walk out and no one would be there.
Yeah. So kind of.
It was different, but gotcha, you know, we adapted.
Okay. Well, I mean, remind me, what grade were you when you said it was the middle of your college experience?
I was a freshman. It was my second semester of freshman year when we went remote, because I remember so vividly, I was in ear training, and we were all talking about it because Harvard had just decided to send everyone home. And in Boston, whatever Harvard calls is whatever the rest of the schools usually call.
Got it.
Then everyone had, I think Berkeley gave their students some more time, but I know for like my like family friend who's like my big brother TJ, he went to Brown and they gave him like 3 days, and so he just left 9 boxes in my apartment and went home to Houston.
Shoot.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
And did I don't know, I feel like there's two directions I can go with this. I'll go, okay, so it was rather eerie. I want to go back to, what was it called, the test called the MTAP? No, the
MTEL.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're mentioning how like it is very much focused and steeped in Eurocentricity. And I again, because our listeners are wide and broad and such, I understand that there is a, so I guess, okay, that make the question to the point. What is the inequality, or what is the problem with focusing on Eurocentricity as a means to enter the music field? Yeah, because I know there's a lot of people who definitely have a love towards the European history. This is what we were taught. And to hear you say that can definitely be jarring, but there's definitely truth behind that also. So like, what is, yeah, to as far as your the barriers to entry, what is the problem with having it being focused on Western music history?
That's a great question. I love this question because I think it is like, it's such a strong point you make about that's what we learn and that's what we're taught is the standard. I think what is like the barrier to entry is like what you said itself, it creates a barrier to entry because a lot of us, that's not our history. And so it's going to be harder for us to learn about that. And like, if it's not, I guess, like I'm thinking more in regards to not the history itself, but like the traditional means of music education, then if someone grew up who is first generation and they don't grow up hearing that kind of music. So I can speak specifically to Massachusetts. Our teaching body is 93.7% white, and so that means it's 7% not white who 6.3, is a licensed educator, something of that sort in Massachusetts. And so it creates this funnel when there's all these things like the inequity we talk about that is kind of stopping people of color specifically from being able to get their licensure and be in the profession. And it starts with kind of just these inherent barriers that make people feel like that music education isn't for them when it is so centered on Eurocentrism. And that's not to say that those things aren't important. Like, I love Czech Four. I grew up doing Suzuki Method and doing like orchestra and learning all of these like grandiose, beautiful orchestral pieces. And I loved it. It is what made me want to be in this field, is because of the community that came from it and how beautiful those pieces are and how it made me feel to play that with my friends. But it's never saying to get rid of it entirely. It's to say, okay, let's have this, but then also equally have things that resonate with our student body, because the things that I had to study for my test don't revolve around what I'm teaching a largely immigrant population of like K through fifth graders.
Gotcha. So then what would you propose? And maybe there isn't an answer. Maybe this is a work in progress. Because I'm with you there. Like, and I agree that like not everyone was, you know, wasn't exactly what we were all taught. It's funny, I was talking with remember Chris Song?
Yeah, of course I remember Chris Song.
Yeah. I remember he and I were chatting. Shout out to Chris, by the way. Congratulations for getting your position in Alaska.
What?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm.
And so the thing was, like, he and I were sharing, like, he said, like, wow, you're a different kind of musician. Because, like, for me, I grew up in folk music. Like, I was a folk musician that was very, like, because my dad, like, he picked up his guitar and traveled around, ended up in Greenwich Village, like, was on in the, wholeheartedly in the folk scene. And I ended up, you know, learning a lot from him. And that was a big rooting, but I also picked up the piano as well. I learned, you know, as we mentioned, that I either do violin or piano as an Asian kid. So, like, I learned a lot of beautiful things from Western classical music, but it wasn't necessarily my homebrew. Like, I went home and listened to Pink Floyd, you know, I went home and listened to Dick. And so what then do you think, how do you think education, or rather the entry points, because I didn't finish that episode. What do you, your episode on Shaking the Tree. What do you think, how can we revise entry points to make it much more balanced for people who are not steeped in Western classical, Eurocentric music?
I don't know. Maybe throw a little Kendrick Lamar in there or something. But I'm kidding. But I think that it really is like the balance of like, yes, we have this, but also, so I think the first thing I think of when you ask that question is how we talk about things that are outside of the Eurocentric, like the European canon.
Yeah.
Because it's usually titled as world music, which is very othering itself. So a lot of it is the language we use when we talk about what else encompasses or could encompass our music education. Because I think the vocabulary we use in education is so important. It's about how we talk about the content. It's how we talk about our kids. And I think when you say world music, that's like, okay, what do you mean world music? Europe's a part of the world.
No, they're not.
Bananas.
It's actually, you know, it's part of the whole lizard people thing. You know?
Exactly. No. Yeah. So I think it's evening it out. So I will commend the MTEL on this one thing when I took it more recently. So when I did my research on it back earlier this year, there was 100 questions in the test questions. And then I think 60 of them were about European history. When I took the test more recently, I would say it still was pretty, really, really heavy on European history-centered questions, but it had some really good critical thinking, like open response questions about like multiculturalism and how we put that in the classroom. So it is like really leaning in that, and like not only the history and the facts itself, but how we like meet our students where they are is like the term that we hear a lot, right? Which like I don't super know how I feel about that phrase all the time. I feel like it's thrown at me a lot sometimes. So
expound.
I'm like,
curious.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
I can sense that, but what's your apprehension with like meet kids where they're at? Like, do you feel like it's just been watered down, or like?
I think it just is like a bit of a buzz phrase. Like it's in the same vein as like, it's the same vein as like I don't like all the time when, and I know it's like that isn't always the intent, so that's why I don't harp on it, but when people are like, that's unexpected, I'm like, girl, so many things are unexpected. Like I think it is very, I with the whole unexpected thing, I don't, do you use that at your school?
No, actually it's not that's unexpected, like as if like what?
If someone is really dysregulated, they're having a lot of behavioral challenges and they need to reset and they do something, so say like I was really upset because I wasn't chosen to be the grizzly bear. And then I pick up like an egg shaker and I throw it. I'm being unexpected.
Oh, I've never heard
of
that.
Have a whole conversation than having just say, friend, stop. That was unexpected. Let's reset or go to the reset corner. Because I think saying like something is unexpected. Well, yeah, that happens sometimes, but also I came to this conclusion the other day when I was talking to my friend Jesse, who's in the master's program at Berkeley, and he was like, I think you, because we were talking about this, and he was like, I think you just like when the kids come to their own like decision and realizing like why you shouldn't do that or why you should do something. And I feel like when we just throw words at them without giving a full explanation, sometimes that's all we can do at the time because they understand that being unexpected isn't good. But also I'm like, I think in the settings I have heard it, it's kind of like, it's very watered down.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
There is an episode I really want to just dive deep in. It's regarding, it's regarding moral injury. I kind of want to chat, like something that I've been processing, but like there was a podcast I was listening to from my pastor runs a podcast and he's talking about like moral injury because a lot of our congregation is houseless individuals. And so it's a big conversation point. And he was chatting with someone else and they were saying how like moral injury or other things like it's important to use it because it allows us to name something, but also it sometimes gets to the point where it just becomes so used that it means nothing in the end. Mm-hmm. So
right.
I feel you there. I guess that's in short, I feel you.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Connect.
Mm-hmm. It's been interesting chatting with more and more folks in music education. There aren't a lot, as you mentioned, there aren't a lot of teachers of color, despite the fact that there is a breadth of students that you be teach. Like, what's the demographic? You don't have to give me the specific numbers, but like, what's the broad demographic at the school you teach?
So the demographic at the school in Framingham is a largely immigrant population. So okay. It's mostly Brazilian and Portuguese speaking students. So most of them are first gen or like have fully just immigrated. So it's a very, very diverse population. I would say like it's a majority minority community.
Mm-hmm. And would you say would you say the teachers reflect that? Like the demographic?
Nope.
No hesitation.
I can say that. Nope. I can tell you on my hands how many teachers of color there are. And because that is something where it's like, it's one of those things where sometimes I get frustrated with myself about this because I'm like, I don't want to make it a thing, but I inherently notice all the time when I walk in a room how many other people of color are around me. And mm-hmm. it's something I've had a discussion with my friends who are white music educators. And they've said like, once I point that out, they start to notice it too.
Sure,
and
it's
just like jarring. It's one of those things, once you see it, you can't really unsee it. Our teachers though, I'll say like at the school I'm at, they are very aware and self-reflective and they address race directly and acknowledge it in like the lens that they approach education, which is something I really appreciate. And I think that's why I love the work environment so much.
That's good.
And I also think I am so happy with this position because of the makeup of the student body. I feel safer mm-hmm. being around a largely Black and Brown student body because it just, there's this kind of this like inherent understanding amongst each other that I feel like, I don't know, sometimes I just, even though, you know, it's interesting, I feel like I feel that way sometimes because I grew up with like two white parents. But when I'm in the classroom and I'm like in the school, I feel more camaraderie inherently because I'm like around people who I look like.
Yeah, that's cool. It's interesting. I feel like the students should feel that way. And yet you're the one that feels that way. Like, that's
teaching has been so healing for me, for like a lack of a better term. Like, I feel like it has helped me so much to be around those kids and like that community, because yeah, you're right, like it's like kind of ironic because I feel like that's usually, you know, the assumption is like, oh, the kids need to see you, but it helps me to see them, especially having grown up like with my own like personal things with like internalized racism and having grown up in a predominantly white community and having two white parents and like not really fully being able to acknowledge race, like it has helped me so much to be around also so many adults and like especially like mothers who are such kind teachers and mothers and people. It's been like life changing.
And again, break it down for audience, because again, our audience members is wide in mm-hmm. breadth. And so like, that's not breadth. Anyways, explain to us from your perspective, why is that? Why is it important for you to see why is it important for, first off, you to see kids that look like you? And also, why is it important for our kids to see others? Like, what is not the information we teach enough? Like, maybe I'm being loaded in this question, but yeah, like, why is that?
For me, I think it's because I see the joy in them, and that, like, I see how happy they are, and that makes me really happy, and I'm already inherently, like, a pretty happy person, but to see them be so safe in their own community and to feel really supported and to see how active and, like, dynamic their friendships are in their community and their guardians and, like, all these people that invest in them, it makes me feel just, like, really safe and really happy to see that for them. Because, like, my own personal, like, home life experience hasn't always been the greatest in some avenues. And so I think it just really makes me happy and safe to see, like, the kids not have to go through that in, like, some capacity. I think for the kids, it's great to see educators of color because they don't know, like, what opportunities they have until they see the representation in front of them. Like, oh, cool, I could do that.
Yeah, like I can count. I'm trying to think. Before in elementary school, I remember having one Filipino teacher, and it was like eye opening. It's like, oh, because I went to a predominantly white school, like for elementary school, and like, you know, except for one teacher, who shall be named unnamed. Like, it was a really positive experience, but there was something special about her, Miss Punsalan. She was just like, oh yeah, wait. You're like me. We have a connected language. And so, yeah, I see that because, like, I feel like, I don't know. I think there's just these two strains of thought with music education and education in general. And I know I'm being very simplistic by saying only two. But, like, this notion that we teach music and music has, you know, quarter notes and eighth notes have no race, you know. So, like,
yeah.
So because of that, we can teach, you know, we don't need to be concerned about racial elements, but in the same sense, like, our kids, they, you know, like, to neglect it would be a disservice to our kids. I don't know if that made sense.
No, I agree 100%. Like, are you talking about to neglect teaching them things that resonate with them more, or also just to neglect, like, teaching them or being, like, a part of that representation? Or I guess all of it.
All of it. Yes. Yeah. The answer is yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So then, okay. Then for you, since even though you are a teacher of color, you are not Brazilian, you are, how do you try to, you're not everything. How do you try to be the representation to your kids? How do you try to bring into your classroom this goal that, because you were sharing earlier that, like, if students can see themselves in their teachers and they feel like they can do, you know, they feel like they can do this. So, like, how do you bring that to your kids?
I think it's listening to what they like to listen to. I'm starting off this year by asking, like, my older kids, like 3 through 5, I'm gonna give them a music survey and ask questions like, what was your favorite song this summer? Who are your favorite artists? If you could be in a band, what band would you join? Or, like, what songs make you want to dance? That's a big thing. I really like to dance with them and be silly, and I feel like that makes them more excited because they're like, oh shoot, Miss Pack can keep up. She kind of crazy lit like us. And so that makes them, I feel like, more engaged, because they're like, hey, can you get sturdy? And you know what? I will. But they love to dance, and they have such a bananas, like, good sense of rhythm. So they will always just do that, like, funk of behind everything. And I encourage it. And I feel like since they are able to, like, express, like, the rhythms they hear all the time and, like, music that ties to their culture. And we also, like, look at music that is, like, not just, like, pop that, like, I'm listening to, but what they're listening to, like, I'll let them give me suggestions and we'll all do it together. And
so what do they listen to?
Get some hype. Sorry, they listen to a lot of Brazilian funk.
Okay. A lot of song, it, that's artists? Like,
I don't have the artist name, but I think it's mostly, like, TikTok compilations, to be honest. Like, if you look up Brazilian funk and then it's, like, a Skibidi Toilet fan cam.
Fan cam?
They've shown
What's
me that?
That
before. Oh, I'll send you some. Okay. A fan cam is, like, when you make an edit of, like, a something that you like. It could be, like, you know, Raising Cane's, or it could be Chapel Rowan. It could be anything. But they will do, like, Skibidi Toilet fan cams to Brazilian funk.
I still don't understand. Sorry, fan cam is like you. So you take a man. I'm feeling old. I'm feeling
no, you're
so
good,
old.
You're good. It's
I am an uncle now.
No. When I said uncle earlier, I meant like cool young uncle.
No. I guess. Well, actually, I am technically I am an uncle actually. But regardless, like, I have a cute 3-year-old nephew across the pond. But regardless, like, Wait, so a fan cam is you take an idea and then you what? Or you
You
take
put
it.
music to it. So,
Okay.
like, say I want to make a Jonathan fan cam.
Okay.
I would like take a bunch of photos from your Instagram and I would put music behind it and it'd
Okay.
have like a sparkly like PowerPoint transition slide, something like that. I'll make you
Gotcha.
one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. So do you have you ever tried having your kids like make fan cams, like specifically as a project for
No, but that's great project-based learning.
Ooh. Okay.
Ooh.
I mean, again, I'm curious if I'm sure this is a pan US situation, but I'm curious if that is mostly an East Coast fan, if that, or if it's like it's if it's widespread. If the youths
No,
are
it's
into
more
that
like,
in my area.
yeah, it's more like Twitter, TikTok, like Gen Z kind of brain rot. Like our humor, I think, is very. So the kids are like Gen Alpha, so they're
Yeah.
even like a little more kooky bananas than me. But like I think Gen Z and Gen Alpha humor is very absurdist humor.
Yes, I
I
noticed.
think, have you watched Community?
I have, yes.
Community was so ahead of its time because it is exactly what Gen Z humor is. It's just like random absurdity because we grew up on like iCarly and like those Nickelodeon shows where it was like random dancing and like it was kind of like the precursor to like CoComelon, like very like high intensity, high sensory, like colors, lights, sounds, like just funky, crazy weirdness. So that's like what our internet humor is now. And also
Gotcha.
because we had that whole like YouTube era. I love like random fact about me, I love 2010s like pop culture. So I can't get on a thing about that because that is the whole thing. That's like kind of where our absurdist humor comes from is like 2010s was so bananas because we were coming out of a recession. So everyone
Sure,
just wanted to
sure.
have fun. Because when the economy is bad, our pop culture and our fashion gets crazier.
It either gets really depressed or it gets cray cray or both.
Right. Because people want to dance. They don't want to think about what's happening.
I remember, after 9/11, I always say that 9/11 killed the boy band because,
Whoa.
like, it did. Like, you didn't see NSYNC, you didn't see Backstreet Boys being
Yeah.
as big, just because people wanted to like focus on sadness and nationalism and all that jazz.
Yes.
Jazz was not allowed, by the way. But it was so yeah. I remember when my students showed me Skibidi Toilet for the first time. I was like, the kids were like, "Do you like it?" I was like, back when I was like. Back when I was your age, it was like you
When
lay
I was
random
your age.
humor. Yeah, lay random was like big, but like
RAR XD.
RARX. Yeah. Okay. Yep. We speak. Okay.
That's still in the schools.
Wait,
That made me
RARXD is
really
still in
happy to see.
schools?
Yeah, someone left a beaded bracelet in the music room that said RAR XD on it. And then also the cheese touch is still, the cheese touch is still happening in my school.
Wait, what's Cheese Touch?
Do you remember Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
No. Oh, Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Oh, okay, yeah. I never
So
read it, but
you,
I knew. Yeah.
the cheese touch was huge for the program. When I was in elementary school, oh my gosh, that was like, you could not get the cheese touch. So that's still happening. So a lot of the things that were like happening when we were like in like K-12 have kind of trickled over. But you know what I think is really interesting is that the kids really like the music that was like 2010s music. Like they love NSYNC. They love Baby by Justin Bieber. They love Imagine Dragons. So
Okay.
they're hip. Yeah.
I feel like there's a point I can if I went down that road, we'd be chatting for another hour. But
Hand
like
down.
my question, I guess partially for one. So you mentioned how listening is important. I think that's key for any educator. But like, what are your thoughts on this notion that we as teachers, we are here to teach the music that they will not listen to? So we have to
Ooh.
be not like on the more strict sense, we have to just focus on X, Y, or Z. If you want to lean more strict, we only focus on Western music, but like, or classical music, but like this notion that we are here to expose them to music that they will not listen to. Should we then incorporate, well, why should we incorporate their music into the classroom? What is your thoughts on that kind of paradigm?
I think that the kids are so much smarter than people give them credit for. I once had in my first week that I was at my school, this teacher came into my room because the music room is between the stairs of the second floor and the third floor, which I love because everyone walks by and says hi. So this teacher, very friendly, she comes in and she had just been sitting in on one of my third grade classes and I was having them do a rhythm echo clap to Love Train by the OJs. And she was like, come on, you can't be playing that old stuff for them. You gotta look on Kids Bop and see what they're listening to. You can't be playing that for them. It's gonna get them bored. And oh my goodness, I was like, there's no way you were telling me this in Black History Month. That is just, you're playing in my face right now. Because the kids love anything that makes them want to move and makes them want to dance, and they'll pick up on that rhythm so quickly. And so that, I think, also like lays to like the idea of like, yes, we should show them like things that they won't traditionally listen to. So yeah, show them a bit of this, but show them a bit of that, like expose them to everything. So I think it shouldn't have to be confined to like one type of showing them something versus another. Like, they deserve to have a smorgasbord, right? That's what people call it, a smorgasbord of music. Smorgasbord.
I like that. And I think it just reinforces this notion. It is, our job is too much for just one teacher. I there is so much in music education. There's as we've kind of talked about, there's a breadth of, I feel like I mean breadth a lot, but there's a breadth of like, I'm just noticing things, that's all. Different genres, like all across. You got weird, you know, from minimalist to like talk about, you know, all the different kinds of cultural bits of, and then, you know, the different eras of each one. It's like, there's just so much. And for one person to teach everything is just, I don't know, it's just too much. I wish we would have, it would be nice if there was more of us, I guess. If there was more supports, if there was more, it'd be great if we had a roaming music teacher, I guess, even that. Like, because
yeah, like a co-teaching situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love co-teaching.
Did you ever do it?
Yeah, I do it all the time for Berkeley. I work for the autism program. Mm. And so I co-teach music class for young children. And it's just like such a delight because it's so nice to be able to like, kind of like go off of each other. And also it takes so much stress off of my plate, because when I'm like in a class of like 20 kids running around, it's just me and like someone is dysregulated and someone needs to go to the bathroom and like all these things, I'm like, oh, all right, well, we're gonna figure that out together. It's just like like never stopping.
Oh, sorry. Oh man. Should I or should I not? That is always the question. You mentioned something in your session. I feel like, mm-hmm. because we're backpedaling a little bit, but yeah. Maybe we'll see if I use this or not. We'll see. Okay. you mentioned this in your session back last July. Wow, it's been over a year.
Wow.
It feels like both yesterday and a long time ago.
Happy 1 year friendshipversary.
Woo!
Yeah.
that you mentioned, one of the last things you mentioned in your presentation, which focused a lot, to those who weren't there, it focused a lot on inequity, a lot on racial inequity specifically. But you mentioned we as teachers of color, specifically AA/ACPI music educators, we cannot tokenize ourselves, but we must make ourselves digestible.
Yes.
Can you expound on that?
Yeah. Okay. I haven't actually thought about this in a long time since like maybe since I presented on it. So okay. I love that you ask that because it's making me think a bit more. So I think when I say like we can't make ourselves tokens, I think it a lot of the times, like as especially like Asian American people, we really play into what the national consciousness decides that we are. So sometimes we're doctors, but sometimes we're, you know, like nail techs and like sex workers, especially for Asian women. This discussion was coming right off the cusp of the ruling on affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really feeling at the time that Asian people were being used as a token or like kind of like a pawn for white supremacy, because a lot of the times the Asian community and the Black community get pit against each other.
Yep.
And that is two sides of the same white supremacy coin. Like, I think about that all the time. And I think in my personal belief, when it comes to America, I believe in Black liberation above all else, because it inherently, when you liberate people who need the most support, you are liberating all of us, and you're supporting everyone who falls into these discourse communities. Like, all these people, like, there are so many factors to how we have helped each other historically, but a lot of the times we're used against each other because of like the male minority myth. We're seen as like someone who's taking jobs, like all these things. It's whatever the news and the national conscience decides like what we are in that day. So I think it's very important when I say, like, it's important for us not to tokenize ourselves. I think I am saying that it's important to have, like, as much critical and whole thought in how we present being a person of color, and acknowledging not only, like, ourselves, but how we play a part to, like, the bigger picture of supporting our, like, Black and brown brothers and sisters as well.
But we must make ourselves digestible.
Oh, yes, that part.
That was the part that, like, I liked. It really caught me. Because I looked through your slides, like, when you sent it over. It's like, this wasn't in there. This is something she said, not off the cuff per se, but it wasn't, like, it was, yeah, it was really stood out when you mentioned it, to the point where I typed it in on my notes, which I don't type notes much. So it was like, yeah, oh. So we cannot tokenize ourselves, but we must make ourselves digestible.
Yeah, okay. So I think I know what I was talking about there, because I think about this all the time. So I'd be thinking, for real.
You'd be thinking.
I said, we must make ourselves digestible. See, sometimes I don't agree with that all the time now, because I like to shake the table quite a bit. Okay. But I think when I say to make yourself digestible, I know when I say this, it's how we say it. And, like, I'm a big person on, like, confrontation is communication. It's just about wording or tone. So when I talk to people, especially, like, people who are not people of color, about the things that I care really deeply about, education, it goes back to the whole thing of, it's never one person, it's the system in itself. So I always want people to feel welcomed into the conversation. It's never accusatory, it's an invitation to collaborate together to make everyone feel included and supported and provide, like, with what is equity in education, like, to be invited into that conversation, because we aren't going to be successful unless we support one another. And a part of that is making what we are trying to relay digestible, because if I came in very accusatory and I came in, like, guns loaded, ready to just, like, be upset at the white man, that's not going to support my statement, because it makes people very turned off to what I have to say. So, and I also, it's just not my style. I want to have a conversation and I want to communicate about it, and I want you to feel safe around me because I want to feel safe around you.
I like that. I feel like this is, I mean, it's hard to not be friends with a white music educator, because, you know, there's not a lot of us. And so, and I feel like this, that's one reason I feel like there's a big apprehension to talk about race. Oftentimes there's this concern that, like, I'm doing it wrong, or people are gonna be concerned I'm doing it wrong, and or that I'm this notion that I am the problem. But as I like that you really highlight, this is a systemic problem, and even though we as people are part of the system, we are not necessarily the system. And I like that you really delineate that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. To make it digestible is to make it, like, an invitation, I think. Yeah.
Well, Rachel, like, I feel like we went in so many different ways, and, like, we talked so much, and I still am so astonished that you have taught less than a year. I feel like you're a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate everything you shared today. And I hope that we can actually chat in person again, and maybe do another session, maybe in person, to have more people at the table that we saw last July.
Oh my gosh, that would be so fun.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I gotta bring back Rachel Profiling. We could do a crazy crossover collab.
We should. So yeah,
I
we
would
should.
Absolutely love that.
I know. Like,
actually, yeah, we should totally do that.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay, good deal.
But my last thing, since again, there's just so many directions I can go with you. Like, I feel like with this, so many, like, people I talk to, like, I mean, sometimes it's very, okay, this is the topic we're talking about. Like, you is like, man, accessibility, you know, like, we make talking about equity and all that jazz. What is one last thing, as a teacher who is as a young teacher, what is something you would like to share to teachers who have been teaching for a long time and have been, I don't want to say stuck in their ways, that's not that, but, like, who have, you know, they've taught, that are, whether they are still active or whether they are stuck in one paradigm, what is one piece of advice or one thing you hope that they see from the perspective of a young music educator?
That's a hard question. Oh, I feel like there's so much. I feel like I'm really lucky that a lot of the veteran teachers I'm surrounded by have been so supportive. But I feel like the biggest thing I engaged with, especially in undergrad, was having like transparent communication. Because I think I'm someone who really appreciates like transparency and like very direct like verbal communication. If I'm feeling some type of way, you're gonna know about it. And I feel like that's the same way things should go in education, to where we're all working towards the same goal of supporting our students. And so if there is something that is like creating a barrier or bothering you or like anything in any capacity, just to like communicate that clearly. And I think like we're a lot more receptive than kind of like people assume us to be for like younger teachers. And I think I'm definitely like, I am a teacher that comes off, especially as a young teacher, like maybe it can come off naive with how excited and like bubbly I am all the time. That's something I get very self-conscious about, especially like being a girl who wears a lot of pink. I think it's very easy to assume that I'm like a bit ditzy.
Sure.
And I think I know that's my own insecurity in that too, but I think it's like, I ask for people to come to me with like full transparency and communication, or else I think that creates another barrier. That's something I asked for all the time in undergrad, because I just felt like there was so much I was confused about, and I didn't understand why things couldn't be a certain way. And then when people started like being forward and talking to me, when I was like really pushing about like, why does it have to be this way? That's when I was like, okay, like this is where the conversation is going, and like we can work together now. And I learned so much from that, because I would walk into the chair of Berklee's music department. I walk into his office, and I'd be like, Dr. Adderley, I need you to explain this to me. And he would. And that meant the world to me, because I felt like full support in that moment. So it's like, if something is a certain way, like tell like your young teachers that, or like explain why, or else we're just going to feel like you're kind of creating like this hindrance for us.
I like that. And I would even say, even like amongst anyone, like especially, yes, to young teachers, but like I think transparency is something that we as all educators can work so much on. And so yeah, I like that.
That's how I try to be with my kids too. Like if they're like, why is something like this? I'm like, hey, I'll tell you. I also like making mistakes in front of them, because I need them, like I want them to see that like I be goofing up sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's all about like the transparency and like kindness and how we like approach things.
That's dope. Cool.
Thanks.
Well, Rachel, it's been a pleasure. And it's a pleasure to call you a friend as well. Thank you so much for this interview, but we have more stuff after the break.
I want to take a quick break and thank my husband, Brian, who's been working behind the scenes producing these episodes every week on all of the platforms and on time. But you need to know that he is first a financial planner for Mission Trails Financial. Mission Trails Financial is a partner that seeks to guide clients in the journey to financial success. They believe that people need a financial advisor that aims to provide strategies for success. Mission Trails Financial helps people navigate investments, tax planning, and insurance. Imagine working with an advisor who isn't tied to specific brands. Mission Trails Financial has a fiduciary responsibility to act in the best interests of their clients by providing independent, objective advice. Their mission is to help clients accomplish their financial goals. As Joe Vitale once said, a goal should scare you a little and excite you a lot. Do yourself a favor and set up a time to chat with Mission Trails Financial. Visit www.missiontrailsfinancial.com or call 619-419-0238 to schedule a call. You'll be glad you did. We believe that leaning on professionals is how we get ahead. Check out the program notes for more information.
And welcome back. Before we get to the spiccato, though, we do have a hard left turn. Thank you, everyone who's been a part of this journey, whether you joined us in episode zero or you joined us now because you know Rachel and she's just, you know, dope chicken. Thank you. Thank you. But if you love this podcast, please do support the things you love. This is a two-person venture run by two full-time educators in San Diego, that city, you know, the one that, you know, costs like $5 billion to live in. So come to our Patreon and drop us a buck, patreon.com/chclassroom. There we have merch, lesson ideas. And if you can't, you know, support us monetarily, that's fine, as, you know, information should be free. But do leave us a review. Go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and just please leave us a review, 5 stars, or actually write something out. I'm tired of seeing B. Arbra as the last review. So please, you know, support us. And also go on youtube.com/@ch-classroom and, you know, just drop us a like and subscribe. So who's going to hurt? Who's going to hurt?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm about to leave a mean review.
Yeah. See, if Rachel can do it, why not you? Mm-hmm. So, Thank you very much. Now, for spiccato, we're going to do another classic spiccato where I'm going to do a rapid, I'm going to ask you like a handful of questions, and most of them, I would like you to just send us to whatever you're feeling, just rapid fire back. Okay?
Okay.
Cool. All right. So what is the best song written in the last 100 years?
Oh my gosh. The first thing that came to mind was Espresso by Sabrina Carpenter. I mean, which I don't think that's my answer. It's something from Beyonce. It's anything by Beyonce. I would say American Requiem by Beyonce. That's my final answer. Boom.
Boom. Stamped. All right. Kill one. Ooh, I'm going to two versions. Kill one. French toast, waffles, or pancakes? Kill one.
Oh, a waffle.
Waffles. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's an option. For me, I would kill pancakes.
Yeah.
Sorry. But
I get that. I like that pancakes are fluffier than waffles.
That's fair. That's
I'm going
fair.
For the fluffy ratio.
Though, if you want to be a heathen, like one of my friends, he loves microwaving his waffles. It's like, you know, those Eggo waffles.
Oh, like a little Eggo situation.
Yes, exactly. But microwaving, when you have a toaster, why not just toast it? But if you love the fluff, then I guess, you know, more power to you. I'm going to do my friends Genesis and Jamie. They love sharing this one where this is the Asian version of it. Like, so you got kill one, rice, noodles, or bread.
Oh, phooey. Wait, I don't feel like bread is Asian, really.
I mean, there's this bowel. There's like. But
I
got
to culture me to it, I guess, more.
Yeah.
I would say bread then.
I got a lot of hate for this. I said rice. I said,
oh, that is a hot take.
I know, it's a hot take, but there's so much diversity in the other two. It's like.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I just, anytime I have rice with something, I'm like, oh, I'm elevating my palate for real. Like, I'm having fine cuisine right now because I got a little bowl of rice on the side.
That's fair. That's fair. My partner, she's all against that. It's like, you rice? Really? Anyway, all right, is a hot dog a sandwich?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bun
Mark
receptacle.
Kiemer. Take that, Mark.
Boom, Mark.
And okay, this one you can slow down your like rapidness.
Okay.
So you can, where do you want to see yourself in 5 years, be it teaching and or personal?
Oh, I was thinking about this earlier today. I've never been someone who has like a 5-year plan, like really like a very strict 5-year plan, but the ideal goal is that I teach in public education, like fully full-time in the school for at least 2 to 3 years, and then I go get my master's. And I want to do my master's in the same thing that I've been researching, which is like specifically analyzing the attrition of pre-service teachers of color. So looking to why we have such a low teaching like percentage of people of color, and like what is the funnel that is causing that.
I know.
Go to Seattle at some point. I really want to go to Seattle for some reason lately.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know. That is such a topic that I touched on, I graced on. I feel like I don't know. I know you have a lot more thoughts to say than what you just shared in this podcast on that topic. And I would love to pick your brain on that. Maybe for a part two. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. This episode is just get to know Rachel and all the smatterings that she is. And I'm sure there's also stuff we've missed, but that's all right. And lastly, do you have any questions for me?
What's your hyperfixation song right now? That's my favorite question to ask people. Wait, can I ask you 2 questions? I have one
after
this.
I'll allow that. What's my hyperfixation song right now? I got to like check my Spotify's. These hyperfixation, it's not really hyper, I'd say. But I definitely go through moods. I'm lately going back into the Lovesick Hexology by Nujabes, rest in peace. But do you know? Yes, no?
No, I'll have to get into it.
Oh, man. He was, would you say he was rather influential in the hip hop scene for specifically like anime hip hop? Definitely check his stuff out. You probably know the song, at least Feather. By him, but he's tragically passed away too young. So, I would say Japanese hip hop. So more leaning into that.
I love that.
Okay, and it's very possible you might have absorbed like some influences from, like, you might have heard some stuff that's influenced by Nujabes. But yeah, that's probably the one currently. I'm also currently having a high off of John Foreman's latest album, In Bloom. So mixture of those two. But yeah.
Okay.
What's your second? I'll allow a second one. Sure.
Okay. This is my favorite question to ask people.
Okay.
What's your dream?
Ooh, my dream.
It can be anything. It doesn't have to be work related. It doesn't have to be like life related. It could be your dream for today. It could be your dream for tomorrow.
I mean, I've shared this several times with my friends. And so like I've been thinking about this actually for the past two or so years. Have you ever seen the Netflix documentary, Ugly Delicious, Dave Chang?
No.
Okay. It's a food based documentary. It talks about like, you know, Chef's Table, or at least Chef's Table.
That sounds really familiar.
Okay. It's another Netflix based food, but it focuses more on the culture of food. And Dave goes more and talks about like, sorry. That focuses more on the art of food. And like where Dave takes it is more of the culture of food, like talking about why is the gnocchi, which is like, you know, like a $32 plate, which is also very similar to a dumpling, very much similar. Whoa. But why is that $32 while a dumpling's poor man's food? Or he's become a little bit more controversial figure amongst the Asian community because he did some stuff with. I'm not gonna get that. But the documentary series was really cool because it was very much just a conversation on food and culture of food and like what like, and so. It brought my eyes to like thinking about, oh, that's cool. What if like, cause like that brought, sorry, backpedal. He not just interviewed like chefs, but he also interviewed like, you know, comedians, writers. And, it was the table was open for us to chat about this art. And what if there was that for music education? Cause for me, visibility is like really important. Like, how can we make things more visible? How can we, like, and that's part of the reason why I'm still, you know, doing this thing with Crystal, because like, how can we make music education? How can we make these little pockets of education? I wouldn't say little pockets, but important pockets of education. Talking about, you know, inequities, like how can we bring that to light? And so that has been something that's been percolating in my mind, and I've been doing some stuff. So if anyone's listening would like to help fund this documentary series that I really would like to jump on. Cause like there's a lot of barriers and whatnot. Like first off, Even though I'm familiar with videography, I would not consider myself professional enough to do this on my own. And also, mm-hmm. I'd rather do the interviewing elements. Right. And also, just like being like part of what made Ugly Delicious really great was that you weren't just having the conversation, but you were seeing the art in front of you. And the art in front of you, in this case, our children. And that takes, and that's a little
complicated
with districts and such. So, yeah, I guess that's been the dream that I'm willing to share at least on air. That is a dream I have. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. What about you? Well, I guess this master's maybe. Is that, or Seattle? Or like,
yeah. Well, like the general dream is to just like always be around my friends and to feel really happy.
Hmm.
My friends are the most important people to me in my life because they've been the most consistent thing my entire life. So they are like of the utmost importance to me. So just to always feel like surrounded by my friends, and even if that's not like in a physical capacity, but to feel like that closeness with them and to just like feel really joyful all the time. That's the dream.
I like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, next off we have Chaotic Beauty. So inspired by different game shows like Family Feud, or for me personally, Kind of Funny's Game Showdown. This is a way to just engage with we asked our audience certain questions regarding music education, and we had 31 people respond. By the way, if you know a better way for us, listeners, by the way, if you know a better way for us to ask these questions and you get them back to us, please let us know. Instagram is not the main modality of us like reaching these questions, because 31 is a nice number. We'd love to have more. As you listened to the last episode with Olivia, like there were certain questions that we could have had. If we had more responses, would have made things more interesting. But alas, we have 31 responses on these questions. And what's going to happen is we're going to ask you, Rachel, five or six of them. And if you get the number one answer, you get 30 points.
Whoa.
From if you get the second best answer, you get 20 points. And if you get the third best answer, you get 10 points.
Okay.
And the goal for you is to get was it 60? I think 80 60? Points. If you get 80 points, if you can get 80 points, then you get our prize. And our prize is a first edition Chaotic Harmony t-shirt.
Wow.
Yeah. And you said you like pink, so that's perfect. So
that's huge for the program.
Just saying. Cool. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Am I ready? That's the better question. So I'm gonna do this is like one or two.
So I have to think about like people's general answer.
Yeah. So
that's hard.
Exactly.
I think about like your audience too.
Mm-hmm. So for example, I'll give you an example. So one of the questions I asked in the last episode was what's a first name of the first name that's commonly used in folk songs? Like John was our top answer. I think you would have liked. I'm curious that your answer for this one.
I think put something really random.
Oh yeah, that's right. You did respond to this, so we'll get at least one vote, maybe.
Okay.
All right. Cool. So let's go jump over to what rhythmic counting system do you use to teach rhythms? And not necessarily you, but what do you think the people have surveyed? What rhythmic counting system do you, the audience, use to teach rhythms?
Rhythmic counting system. So, like, my immediate answer is, like, ta. Like, ta, ta, ti, ti, ta. Or some people do takadee. Well, takadee. So, yeah. I'm going to go ta, ta.
So, ta, 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 ti, ti. That is our 20-point answer.
Yes, T-Bone. Yeah.
By the way, audience, please only state one response. I had some people thrown in, it's like a mixed batch. Next time, I'm just gonna. I guess some people said, "I Tatiti and talking to me." No, just choose one.
Just one.
Okay, so that's 20 points on the board. Wonderful.
Okay.
Name a popular folk dance.
Oh, I should know this. the bell one, the wind chimes and the bells. I can't think of the full gum name right now. I redact Alabama Gal. That's a big one, right?
Alabama Gal is our 20-point answer.
Hey! Okay, work.
Cool.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, going back. So the last one, Takanimi, was our 30-point answer by 1 point. So, Kadai was our Taz and TT's was our second. And just I forget what it's called, the number system 1, 2, 3, and 4. There's a name for that. Like Eastman, was it? I forget. I don't know. So that was for the last question. For this question, our number one answer was Sasha. And that comes with a really big bias because a lot of people who respond to this are Chula Vista folk. And that was when Joshua Block came to us, like that was something that really, brought us together.
Yeah. I was about to say that one because that's like the main one that I know. But I was like, for some reason, I thought it was like I thought it was low key.
No. It was really cool. So, first off, we also had our ORF past president is named Sasha. And so that even like made us all, yeah. And then also, I think, I want to say 2 years ago at the banquet for AOSA, the band knew it was up because they were like, one of them was like, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners. Was an ORF person, and so they played Sasha. The live band played Sasha, so we all just like went wild. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So Sasha was our number one, Alabama Gal, and then the Chimes of Dunkirk. If you just said chimes, I would not have given it to you. There's a lot of dances. I'm sorry. All right, so you have now 40 points. All right, next off, name an instrument that most students drop out from. This kind of confuses a lot of people. Violin. Violin is our 10-point answer. So we had the flute was top, which was tied also with piano. And then the violin. My answer was clarinets, but no one chose that, so whatever. But flute, I feel. So you have now 20 plus 20 plus 10, which is 50. You need 30 more points to win.
Okay.
Was it? Yeah. I actually think it was 60. I think you need 60 points. I think you need 10 more points. We'll figure it out. We're learning as we go. We're learning as we go. And if you get 80, then you get nothing else. So name a non-Western instrument that belongs in every class's instrumentarium.
Tubano.
Tubano was our, tied for third, but we had so many people tied for third. So you have 60 points. So
okay.
So congratulations. You got the 60. Yay! Let's see if you get 80 just for funsies. But okay, number one by far was djembe.
Oh.
I think, so next one was the Ogogo Bells. Which is like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I was surprised by the tubanos because I feel like a lot of people have tubanos. Like,
I think I have more tubanos than djembes.
Okay. Well, I think this is what people wish were. I think it was probably on me not having my question too clear. There were some other interesting ones, but someone wrote just diverse percussions, like, bruh. Okay. Moving on. Name a pop song typically used in the music classroom.
Happy by Pharrell Williams.
Happy by Pharrell Williams is tied for third as well.
Oh,
so
nice. Okay.
We had Shake It Off, Taylor Swift. Oh, that was number
one. I was going to ask if I could guess. Yeah. Oh, that was a close second.
So what do you think it's like the second place?
I think it's Thunder by Imagine Dragons.
Thunder was tied for third. There's like one, two. It's a 4-point tie. So Best Day of My Life, American Authors. That was our second place answer. The tie for
Firework on there?
Firework was also tied for third. Can't Stop the Feeling, tied for third. And Thunder. And so, yeah. All right. So you are at 70 points. Let's see if you can get to that. Let's see if we can get to it. Name a composer you see on everyone's composer wall.
Bach.
Bach is... Man, you're nailing the 10-point answers. That's 10 points. So,
okay,
Bach,
boom.
Okay. So you got 80, which is cool. Beethoven, by far. Beethoven, then Mozart, then Bach. So...
Yeah.
Other people there wasn't that many other options. One person wrote Carl Orff. It's like, okay, you got bias, sir. You got bias. Scott Joplin. It's like, okay. I don't see them at once, but that's cool. Tchaikovsky.
Love that.
Yeah, love that. Yeah. And Tchaikovsky. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So congratulations. You have won. Now, there still are going to be two more, which I think I'm just not going to. Let's just ask you more for questions for funsies.
Okay.
So, juxtaposed against that one, what composer wall should be on every teacher's composer wall?
Ooh.
And you can imagine this one was very widespread.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people are going to see, like, Amy Beach, right? I feel like I've been hearing about her a lot lately. Scott Joplin. I'm trying to think of who else. Oh, man. There are definitely so many more, but I'm like heavily blanking right now, which is not a great look.
So what would you like if you were to what would you land on
it to the Rachel fell to a hush to pick one. I mean, I feel like I feel like Scott Joplin is like super important because like Jelly Roll Morton, you know, all that good stuff.
So is that your answer?
Yeah, that's my answer.
That is tied for first. Okay.
Okay, so, work!
Yeah. The ones that are, I'm not going to list all of them, but the ones that are first, Scott Joplin, Moses Hogan, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh.
Someone said the female ones. Like, bro, come on. Like, something. Florence Price, which I was surprised. Like, Florence Price is actually on my list. It's like, you know what? Congratulations to those who are, you know, knowing stuff. And last one, which was my favorite, Amir. Let the kids see themselves. It's like,
that's cute.
That's good. I like that's good. Shout out to whoever did that one. And that is it. So congratulations. You got the 80 points. So congratulations. You've got yourself a Chaotic Comedy t-shirt. We'll get to you that later on. But
whoa.
Rachel, awesome. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And I know this will not be our last chat.
Oh, definitely not.
But question for you, would you like to, is there anything you would like to plug? Like, whether it be something you're working on right now, because I know you already had your publication, but maybe you want to chat that out, or maybe your podcast or whatever. Plug what you have, everyone.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'll shout that out. That was my first piece of academic writing ever. So I'm like super duper proud of it. So MMEJ, page 37, spring edition, 2024. I wrote an article called Where Do We Go? Analyzing the Attrition of Pre-Service Teachers of Color, and that tied directly to my Massachusetts Music Educators Association convention presentation. So super proud of that one. That one has like all the data alongside like what we talked about a lot today and why we don't see educators of color. And also the presentation that I gave is on racial profiling. So that's a good tie-in, I guess. It's the latest episode of racial profiling. But you know what? Today has convinced me to come back. So I do want to start being more frequent. So if you look up racial profiling on Spotify or podcast, Apple Podcast, or, you know, wherever you favorite listening to podcasts, it's up there. R-A-C-H-E-O. And then profiling. I if you really want to know like what I'm up to teaching, I yap a lot on my Instagram. Jonathan knows this. I'm just always on there saying something.
Yeah.
But my Instagram is Rachel Profiling, but the O in profiling is a zero. So that's where I'm at.
Did someone else take that name? Is that why?
Yeah.
Bruh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Okay. And also, so feel free to message her and say how awesome she is there. You can also message and ask me questions at Mr. Seligman, MrSeligman on all the socials. And also you can find us at CH Classroom. But if you would like to send us an email, make sure you email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com. Rachel, it's been a pleasure.
I had such a good time.
I'm glad.
Seriously, thank you so much for having me on. Like, I was so excited for this all day. And I'm just, like, so glad that we connected at the, like, AAPI gathering and everything. And I'm just grateful that, like, we've stayed in contact this entire time. Because it seriously is, like, such a welcoming presence to be friends with you and everyone from that gathering. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Who should I interview next from that gathering?
Oh, my gosh. That's such a hard question. Because everyone there is awesome. So you talked to Darlene, right?
You can send it to me if you feel apprehensive via PM. Or, I mean, yes, I talked to Darlene. Darlene's been on our app. She's done a two-parter with us, so.
Okay, I feel like I didn't talk to Genesis a lot, but I feel like he's a very insightful person. So I feel like Genesis and also, Dion. Definitely Dion Flores.
Yeah. Genesis is on the list. Like, he and I were friends before that. So, like, I know I want to make sure he's on this podcast. But Dion, no, I connected with him really well. And, like, I connected with everyone. Let's be real here. But, like, no, we had a good conversation on a lot of stuff. So, cool. All right. Well, anywho, Rachel, I know it's, like, super late over there now. So, I will see you on the flippity-floppity. But, everyone, thank you so much for listening. And bye.
Bye.
The Chaotic Harmony Podcast is a joint project between Crystal Pridmore and Jonathan Seligman. You can find us online at chaoticharmonyclassroom.com. You can email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com and let us know what you think. Give us feedback about what you would like to hear in future episodes. We're on all the socials. Find us on facebook.com/chaoticharmonyclassroom. You can find us on Twitter at chclassroom, Instagram at chaoticharmonyclassroom, and you can even find our episodes on YouTube. Chaotic Harmony is the name of our channel. Special thanks to Brian Pridmore for his help with production and equipment. www.pridmoria.com.
How are you with Mexican food? Yay? Nay?
Yay. I'm from Texas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this may be a different kind, but like I've told Darlene when I first met her, I was like, you should go to Tacos El Gordo. I swear it's the best Mexican food north of the border.
So, okay.
Yeah. It's a high bar, but alas.